Okay, well, welcome everybody to the Climate Literacy Network call. First, I will ask if there are any announcements. One thing I do know is that the AGU sessions have now been approved, and so we have a nice suite of climate literacy sessions, and once I get through the next week, I will send an email out. What we'd like to do is send a list of all of those sessions with the very brief descriptions and start soliciting contributions, contributed abstracts. We'll also have the session conveners identify invited speakers. The other group of sessions that we want people to submit abstracts to is for the GSA meeting. We have two climate literacy sessions there. The abstracts for both of those are due in August, 1 week apart. I can't remember which is which. I think GSA is due first, like August, by August 8th, and AGU by August 14th. So we'll get that announcement out sometime in the next week or so.
I do have some updates. This is Doug Cohen in the Pacific Northwest region, where Scott and I have been talking about a variety of implementations, but there's traction with Portland State University, the Institute for Sustainable Solutions, and at the U of O, where they also have, coming out of Evergreen College there, some of you may know, the curriculum for the bioregion. Mm-hmm. So I have an increasing both students, faculty, administration, community groups. There was a climate forum I participated in Portland a couple of weeks ago that had that was the intersection of climate change and depth psychology. So there were people
psychology?
From all over the world. That was a very interesting interdisciplinary meeting. So now the news is simply good continued traction of constituencies to bring curriculum and programs to in the Northwest.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are there any other announcements? Okay, well, if not, we'll move on to our presentation for today. We have Steve Schneider, who received his bachelor's and PhD degrees in physics, but has been involved in informal science education for quite a while. He is currently the vice president of exhibits and program development at the Franklin Institute, and he's going to be talking to us about communicating urban climate change. And from the Climate and Urban Systems Partnerships, it's a CSEP, NSF CSEP program. And so everybody should be able to get the slides from the website. And with that, Steve, I'll turn it over to you.
Sure. Thanks. So I'm going to just kind of fill you in on kind of what we've been working on over the last 2 years or so in developing in an approach to how do we talk to urban audiences about climate change. I don't need to tell anybody here that obviously the urban setting is going to be play a critical role in our response to this, and it poses some fairly unique challenges in terms of the diversity of the audience, the issues the audiences are facing, and other than climate change and how those impact people understanding climate literacy and actually getting engaged. So this project is a collaborative effort between the Franklin Institute, the Carnegie Museum of Natural History in Pittsburgh, New York Hall of Science in Queens, the Koshland Science Museum in D.C., with partners at up close, the Center for Out-of-School Learning at the University of Pittsburgh and the Center for Climate Systems Research at Columbia. And what we've been doing is really trying to look at how we approach this question of reaching urban audiences and how we will what's a good way to actually make the penetration in the breadth of audiences that you have in cities. And one of the things we first undertook was to do kind of a large landscape study of in those four cities, New York, Pittsburgh, D.C., and Philadelphia. What does it look like? Who's involved in climate change education, and what are they doing? And what we discovered was there's a lot of groups. There's sort of the groups you normally think about. There's groups that are specifically have a climate education or climate literacy focus to them, sort of climate educators, science museums, schools, some university groups, some groups specifically focused on environmental issues. And then in addition to those, there are this other group of, you might call, climate affinity groups. These are organizations that have that don't see climate education or even really perhaps education as the focus of what they do, but are very concerned about this. The best example that we've been using is in Philadelphia. There's a group called the Food Trust. Their charge, their purpose for existence is how do they bring fresh produce into urban settings? How do you make those accessible, fresh food and produce in an area that usually has mostly processed food? And they do this by locally sourcing, local agriculture, bringing those foods in through farmers markets and a number of other techniques in terms of trying to get small shop owners to stock these foods. Obviously, climate change is a big concern for them because they're very much dependent on local farmers and what's available, and they have a big interest in it, even though they don't do any direct action in terms of educating the public about climate change. So we looked at those two groups, and when we then look at what those groups are doing, is many of them are talking about climate change. Many of them are talking about this other thing called global warming, which in people's minds are two different things. And many of them are talking about something completely different in different languages, all in different languages, all in different ways, all in different directions. And what this results in, as we were kind of assessing what's been going on in the cities, is really this cacophony of information, this very disparate, dispersed effort. Everyone's putting a lot of effort in, and people are reaching people individually, but often these folks are receiving conflicting messages from different entities. And not that they conflict in terms of the facts, but they superficially conflict in terms of what the threats of climate change are. If we're worried about sea level rise and we're worried about drought, that seems to conflict, and basically, therefore, climate scientists don't know what they're talking about. Obviously, there's disagreement because these groups who purport to support this notion are giving a different language. And we, in a sense, kind of work against each other without realizing or intending to. So the challenge as we've worked forward is to look at, well, how can we turn that around? How can we kind of change the angle of this so that instead of talking to discrete groups with discrete messages, we can kind of get everybody on the same page, singing off the same sheet of music, kind of singing in resonance, if you will, with the messages, with the information we're trying to, with the educational approaches we're trying to take, so that those messages and those efforts can be reinforcing, so that someone who's in if I'm very much into gardening and I go in on a Saturday and work in my urban garden and I come back to my neighbor who quite frankly could not, given his backyard I could tell could not care less about gardening, is working on his car, his auto shop. If those two folks could have seen the same message from two different points of view in two different places, then there's an opportunity to kind of build some resonance within that neighborhood, within that context. If I can see multiple reinforcements of that information across multiple different settings, all within my neighborhood, it has some real potential there to, again, to those messages and those efforts to be reinforcing. So that's really how we've looked to structure the project, is to say, in each of these cities, we have built these local networks of partners, both those who are dedicated to or have an education mission and those who are these affinity groups, to get together and have these discussions about how do we work together to bring our messages out? How do we work together to reinforce the information we're trying to do so that our educational efforts can leverage one another? And one of the things we discovered, which was fascinating, was, and we had lots of group meetings in all these cities, but pretty much at some point in time during one of these sets of meetings in each city, the first time everyone gets together, everyone walks in and says, "Hey, Bill, Joan, how are you?" Everyone knows each other. Right, we're all in the city, we're all in the nonprofit business in the main. We all know each other, we've all been in meetings with each other. But invariably, at some point in time, as we've been having these group meetings, someone stands up and says, "You know, this is great because we've all known each other. We all talk, but we never talk about doing anything together." And so it really just reinforced this notion that we have these efforts and resources within these cities. We have all of these groups trying to move in the same direction, but really in an uncoordinated way. And so the idea of arranging some shared language, arranging some shared efforts, of timing things so that if our horticultural society is doing something for teachers, that this museum is doing something for students at the same time that reinforces, that's being done the same time as the food trust of the farmers markets. so that there can be a saturation that's available there within neighborhoods that wasn't there before. So, again, that's the basic concept of the approach. And then the next question was, if we do that, then what do those messages need to be? How do we need to talk about climate change? So one of the things we know as we've looked at this and as we've talked in the focus groups with people is that it ranges from having no idea to some people never even heard of the term, which is surprising these days. It's really all over the map in terms of what people know and how people react to that. But we also know that what's very clear is that one message or one set of dire warnings doesn't fit all, and the dire warnings aren't necessarily the best approach. People don't react well to that. And we ran into this as we talked to people who are saying, well, we did some focus groups in the winter. I said, well, I'm worried about keeping my heat on. I really could care less what's burning there as long as I can afford what's burning. And the issues of what's the prominent issue in terms of the audience you're trying to reach is a key factor of this. And so when we go to think about the approach for what kind of how we want to do this kind of joint educational approach, what we really focused on with this idea is we need to start with these personal passions. What are the things that people are specifically, individually passionate about? What matters to them? Whether it is their utility bills, or in a lot of cases, in a lot of neighborhoods, we deal with ever-rising asthma rates, that's what they're concerned about. It may be health issues, it may be power, energy issues, it may be environmental issues, it may be food and sourcing good food for my family. What are those things that matter to them personally? And then connecting those things, those personal passions, to the urban systems that support it. Rather than saying that, look, food just shows up at your table, it's a question of where do you get it, it's where. What's the system that allows you to get that food? What's the system that sets the pricing for that energy? What's the system that's supporting what the air quality is to trigger that asthma? What are those basic urban systems that matter and are connected to those things that you're passionate about? Those are easier draws, we've seen, for people to make, to connect to, because they're, in many cases, they're obvious to them. They see them. They work with them under the notion of climate. And then connecting the notion of a changing climate, how that affects that urban system, because that's how it's effectively going to directly impact them. So if we can draw the line between how a changing climate affects the urban system, how that urban system is connected to, again, those things you're personally passionate about, that gives us a way to connect why a changing climate and how it connects directly to you. It's not about all the respect to the zoo down the road. It's not all about the polar bears, because for many of these people, they've never seen one. They're never going to see one. It's very removed from them. And so in these settings, it's really going to have to be directed towards that personal passion. And if we can connect the idea of climate change to something they're personally passionate about that really matters directly to them, then there's this opportunity for action, whether it's action on the urban system in terms of changing climate. We were talking about adaptation and mitigation. That's one of the key things that needs to happen. So those are that's in a sense the theory of how we wanted to move forward with providing the educational interventions, those coordinated interventions, to those audiences, is really focusing on the passion, the urban system, and then how the climate connects back to that. We also noticed that on the action side that we need to provide ways for people to take action, not necessarily subscribing what action they should take, but we need to give them connections. And the other advantage here is to say that the connections in an urban population is not you change your light bulb, because as we all know, it doesn't matter if I change my light bulb, it only matters if we change our light bulbs. How do we directly connect those folks who have the personal passions to groups who are actively involved in doing something? Whether that is, the local neighborhood, a community development corporation, or a group like the Food Trust, or a group like Penn Futures, or any of the groups who are actively doing something about this, finding ways for them to immediately get engaged in a larger scale action than just something they can do personally and making that connection. And that's one of the key things of hubbing this on something that people are personally passionate about, because that's where we have the opportunity to connect to that action. So the final major piece of kind of the theory here was to say, well, if we look at these, the personal passions are all different. We're not going to do this on a one-to-one basis because we're talking about cities. So what's that boundary? How do we group people together? And that really is looking at, communities. What are the communities that have and that grew up around shared passions, that grew up around those shared systems, that grew up around those shared impacts? And so we've identified across the cities four major four ways that we're going to look at four of those basically communities, the physical communities, your neighborhood. It's funny how many cities you ask and say, oh, we're a city of neighborhoods. Every city is apparently a city of neighborhoods, and it's not surprising since that's what makes up cities. But we have these physical neighborhoods where we have, again, shared neighbors, shared resources, shared opportunities for connection. So how do we reach into those physical communities and have a physical presence there? And this is everything from, and this is where, you know, you activate those partners who are currently providing educational interventions. How do you have programming at the community garden? How do you have it at the community center? How do you have it at the CDC, Community Development Corporation event? How do you have it in the grocery stores and the bodegas where people shop? How do you have it where they live, work, and play, directly where they are? How do you bring those interventions into that in a coordinated way? And we've done some pilot testing with that and putting messaging and putting programming around in everywhere from stores to restaurants to parks to gardens to bus shelters to really kind of, in a sense, use that neighborhood as a platform for the communication. The next one we talk about is virtual communities. Obviously, there are a number of communities that come together through digital resources that allow people who are not physically connected to connect through a shared passion. One of the things there, in particular in New York, there's a group of health-related organizations that are dealing with folks with asthma, where there's a very passionate community dealing with these issues that come together, and most of their connections are digitally. So how do you connect them digitally and be able to provide, across all those organizations who serve them, shared digital spaces for them together with shared climate literacy information, interventions, activities, et cetera, to support those communities in some ways? How do you create those virtual maps of what's happening, virtual maps of air conditions, air quality? How do you create those pieces where people can share those pieces and share that community in a digital format? Then we also have these, what we're calling our temporal communities, these festivals. In cities, there are a continual stream of festivals, and it seems like every weekend there's some festival somewhere here, whether on the neighborhood level or a citywide level. And that's a time when a community with around some shared interests, some shared passion, comes together. Again, physically disconnected, oftentimes digitally disconnected, because it's not required folks to be kind of in that digital world, and they come together. The advantage of these settings is that all those groups are there. You know, the institute is there, the Franklin Institute is there, the museums are there, the energy groups are there, the food groups are there. All those groups have presence at these festivals for completely other reasons. And it's, in a sense, a microcosm of this. We're all there. We're all maybe talking about it using different language and different techniques. So the idea here is providing some kits about around some shared topics where you may go through and encounter these kits at multiple booths within a festival, so multiple times during that time you're there, each one with a slightly different element to that piece, but all connected to kind of reinforce it. And part of the idea here is really forcing the effort that not just is the information out there, not just is the interventions out there, but also that this is something that your community, whether it's that festival community, the neighbor community, that virtual community, is concerned about. It's kind of trying to bring in this notion that, that it's part of the norm. This is something that we care about as a group and as a community, not something that I care about alone or a group outside cares about. It's something that we care about. And then finally, the final piece is this kind of communities of practice. These groups, these local networks in the cities, further building their ability and willingness and strength in collaborating across the efforts that they're making to continue to leverage the investments that they make, not just within this larger group, but individually. Really, how do we foster that? How do we improve their skill set of talking about it? Because we also recognize that we've seen is the skill set of these groups in terms of providing material and education varies significantly. So bringing them, in a sense, up to speed with some shared opportunity and building that larger community in place. So those really are the three major pieces. How do we get the groups all together to be singing on cue? How do we focus this on personal passions within communities? And then how do we use these pieces across these communities to leverage that? Ultimately, in a full application, if you're in a neighborhood, there's the neighborhood rollout. The festival rollout happens. The digital rollout happens. And these platforms all happen simultaneously. So there's opportunity for this kind of cross-platform learning to occur, that I may encounter something digitally, I can encounter something in a neighborhood, I can encounter something in the festival, but really it's this idea of a saturated, resonant, coordinated approach across the city to providing these educational opportunities and the information that's needed. And we've done a little bit of private pilot programming. We took a space out where we basically took an active area where we had a farmer's market. We basically had signage and some programming going on there. We covered the food trucks who are in the area, a big food truck town right now, Philly is. We were in corner stores and bodegas, and by basically putting climate information panels in the spaces where usually the price tags are related to the foods that you were looking at community gardens, also at some restaurants, some public bathrooms, really any place we could put some pieces. And this was really just looking at how signage worked in terms of how this plays out, but also a limited amount of programming. And we really wanted to see, one, could we get everyone to play together? And play together really for no additional money. and would could we really coordinate in a good way? Would stores, restaurants, parks allow this kind of thing? You know, how difficult would it be to actually get this into place? And we were really kind of pleased with the overall results. The partnerships, without fail, anytime we walked into someone, say, sure, the local bodegas were absolutely fine with us putting material onto the shelves. They were very supportive of this, very willing to welcome us into this piece, the restaurants and bars as well, although one of them would only let us go on the bathroom stalls, but that's fine. Anytime people are reading, it's an opportunity. Worked very well. Investment was extremely low, which was really key to this. If we want to be able to reach urban populations, which number in the millions, you know, it can't be an expensive proposition on a per-person basis. So the investment here of time was low, and the other organizations were willing to invest their time because they saw it as a corollary, as an extension of what they do. It wasn't asked to do something brand new, but it really was just rolling something into what they already, the efforts they already make. And the reactions of the folks who encountered these pieces were very positive as well. A lot of the biggest things we got were, well, what do I do? What do I do? What can I do about this? So really looking for that opportunity to activate further their connections and what they do with the piece. And the other piece we recognized here was the issue of scope, of just how much scope and how kind of concentration is necessary for people to encounter this. And it's pretty, you know, you do need a pretty good density in a sense of opportunities for people to actually have these kind of cross-messaging pieces. Now, this pilot was only over a period of 2 days as opposed to a month or more, so we think there'll be a relationship in terms of longer amounts of time and how dense the materials and interventions need to be laid out. So that's kind of a real quick whirlwind, if you will, of kind of the approach we're taking, what we've kind of gotten established, and I say it's really been gratifying to see the response of these other partners, these network partners, in terms of what they want to do, of the opportunity to work together, and how in many cases it just takes someone to raise their hand and say, you know, why don't we, and to pull that group together to get these things to happen. So with that, I'll be happy to take any questions or receive any virtual digital tomatoes you want to throw my way and go from there.
Thanks so much, Steve. Really appreciate it.
Sure.
Are there any questions?
This is Karen Holwig. I'm wondering what kind of messages you had, Steve, in these pilot settings.
What we did was, we focused really on food because of the access we had. Again, the farmer's market, the food trucks, the corner stores. And so these really, most of these related to changes they could see. We did this past fall, so Irene was still in folks' minds up here in the Philadelphia area. And so we focused a lot on the fact that, changes in the produce that they would see in the markets. In the corner stores, we focused on I'm trying to remember now exactly which ones we did. We did things, I think, particularly on availability of certain staples like rice, and how climate is tied to their availability and the pricing associated with them. in the we did it at coffee shops and restaurants. We had sort of little conversation starters. The notion being that again, not just from coffee, but what are those the things that that you find in the foods that really are problematic and you may have to do without? What are you willing to do without? To see if we could generate conversations for people while they were sitting, which worked well. So it was kind of a variety of experiments to see how those things, which things played, which things generated conversation.
Steve, this is Scott Carley here. I'm really curious how you negotiated those kinds of messages. You said initially that part of the issue, and I certainly agree with this, is that people were getting a whole variety of different messages from different sources. And one of the things that you really wanted to do is to bring those more and more into alignment. And I'm just curious how you brought these various groups into alignment and say, okay, here's what we should focus on. This is what we want to be able to talk about and communicate.
It actually really was remarkably simple. It was really just kind of throwing out ideas and letting them, which are the ones that people
kind of gel around. There wasn't much
conflict
in the groups. There wasn't much conflict amongst the groups in terms of the messaging. Once they started seeing, a focus on food products and food.
Right, it really wasn't. Because I think the bigger issue with all those groups is, and we're talking about this, it really is. I think it's not a matter of which issue you're focused on. It's the broader issue that everyone's behind. It's the broader understanding. So really the question was, well, where are the best opportunities for us with this audience in this neighborhood? And with, again, the timing and those details, which was the ones to hit with. Now, as we go forward and things become more complicated, then there may be some more of that. But I think it's I think one of the things that we discovered was that people were very receptive to this because of the notion of a shared community,
right.
A shared community being active. That we all knew each other. We've all been in various meetings where we hear reports.
A lot of trust.
Yeah, but the idea of actually saying, let's do something together, I was like, okay, great, let's do something. And no one had a particular, oh, we've got to do my particular issue.
Another question, this is Doug. I was glad to see and now curious about the communities of practice as the final one there, and asking, have they already been begun, or are they a future structure that's coming down the pike? And
well, the real work on it is kind of coming down the pike. I mean, they've started in the sense that we've been having regular meetings with these groups, which within the cities, which I think is already going a long way to kind of moving from, again, parallel organizations who have a shared interest to groups who are working together. That's sort of the first step. But then longer term, it's really what are those resources? And we're really going to have to work on what are the resources that are most helpful to those groups and helping them gel as groups.
So that's a helpful answer, and I'll just make you this information and offer available. In my background with sustainability ed and in higher ed as well as community settings, communities of practice are a core modality that we've been using for many years in the UN Decade of Education. So I have been working just out of last week in Portland, as was mentioned at the top of the call, with a new COP format of both demonstrating and train the trainer that very effective. So I can offer you the resource of 20 years of practice in creating effective COPs.
Okay, great.
For other folks, COPs refers to communities of practice. It's kind of jargon.
Yes, it's an inside.
All the time, too.
Acronym.
Yes.
Stephen, this is Frank Niepold over at NOAA. I'm assuming that this model that you're working on, you've discussed scalability to other cities, other states, other regions. Could you discuss that some?
Sure. Well, one of the key pieces with this is with this approach of, again, how do you pull existing resources, is that we want to be able to develop this in a way where it really is about utilizing the investments that are already made rather than a lot of new program development. So the idea really would be is, well, how do you pull these groups together? What are those kind of ways of developing the shared messages? What are the best, most effective, including efficient ways of reaching to the neighborhoods? We'll be developing some tools for the digital format and some of those kits, which are easily scalable. Those are just easily transferable. But the idea is to base this on a lot of the work on investment that's already been made by these digital organizations, which also points to the longer-term sustainability. The Institute's never going to go away. We've been doing this stuff since 1992, this topic in particular. This is part of our general mission. So it's just a matter of how we direct that mission. And rather than directing it independently, can we direct it in coordination with the Academy of Natural Sciences, with Penn Future, with these other organizations who also have are making a direct investment? So that's really one of the core things about as we push this model through is how do we make it basically utilizing what's there as the primary way of implementing this, as opposed to, having to really do a lot of new development each time.
But just to follow up, if you don't mind, the example you used was specifically to, I think, Philadelphia, my home city. But mm-hmm. What about New York or Chicago or St. Louis? Because the network, the community of practice, the partners who are active in this field who already have resources deployed would really be different. And so one of the pieces I would imagine is a cross-city transfer, and that would require, some either marketing or awareness building or something to get people to draw together at their level of community. Is that
right? Sure. And the larger project here is in the four cities. So New York, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and D.C. And the way we're breaking this out is that one of those communities, the physical, temporal, virtual, et cetera, is being developed in each city, and then we're going to literally transfer that and each adopt it. So we're actually going to go through the process of how would you adopt one of these platforms, how would you implement this in a city, in a sense, raw, so that we can clean that up and make that as smooth a process as possible, including the notion of how do you pull those folks together. One of the key things, though, here is, and it's not just because that's what we are, but the core partner, the hub of each of these networks is the Science Museum, Science and Natural History Museum, because in cities they have a very unique neutral ground opportunity, because they usually, in many of these cases, have a great network in existence already they can pull from. So there's a power being able to say promote and identify those groups and pull them in, that can be done, finding, again, what's the right key partner in the city to be able to kind of be the hub or the core of that. Someone has to be the convener. And so I think that's really going to be one of the key things here is when we think about dissemination or moving this to other cities, is who can play that role in the city to be that place where people will come to begin that conversation.
And can you take that just one step further and say, and how that core organization supports the effort with staff financially?
Yeah, I think that's the big that's going to be the big question. From our point of view and looking at this in a long-term way, is that, as I say, this is something that we are that we do. This kind of work is something we do. In terms of, again, it's from the Science Museum, it's part of the core mission that we have. I can imagine if we had a nice, efficient, effective way that wouldn't require a lot of development to be able to implement something like this where I could reallocate some time to do this. I also think there's local potential opportunities, both from sponsorship and from the development side, at a scaled-down way to be able to support some of this work of convening and pulling groups together. But at the end of the day, it is still, there's still, I say there's no free lunch, even if it's collaborative. The idea here is how do we lower those costs as much as possible to have the largest kind of impact so that basically the investment and return has a high enough margin to make it worthwhile.
Steve, this is Scott Kyle again. I'm curious whether you've had done any work looking at the differences between urban audiences and sort of a general population, as measured by some of the sort of national surveys. Is there anything particularly distinctive about urban audiences that, is very helpful in developing the messages?
I think that the issue there is it's just some of the what are those things that, that are more forefront in their mind when we're looking at this? I mean, there's when we look to see what I think there was. Well, there was two things. One was we discovered that it's very interesting how little people identify with their city and how strongly they identify with their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
But time and time again, we saw this preference where, well, there's the city, but then there's my neighborhood. And so there's a real strong affinity within that, you know, more local, hyper-local, if you will, group in terms of how they see themselves. And this is really across the cities. That's a very strong and powerful kind of tool that, that, again, allows the neighborhood piece to be something that could we see could be functional here. Otherwise, we are just also wrapping up a more extensive, you know, Six America-style study in terms of looking at urban audiences to see is there a shift, at least the ones we're looking at. We did notice some other pieces, though, that, pardon me, that I think, you know, it's issues like the health issues were very front and center for these audiences. They seem to be a very big part of what what's more resonant with them than we see with, for example, when we look at suburban audiences that come into the museum. They take those, that's interesting, and certainly, but really they were very high on a lot of the importance lists in a lot of the neighborhoods.
Steve, I just, one of the things that I would sort of suspect of this, and I don't know quite how, when I guess we can figure out how to test it, but I would think that many urban audiences don't quite understand, you know, literally where food comes from, water, all of those kind of things. So there's a disconnect from the natural world, and then that's something that also needs to be explored in a way that you would never have to do in a rural setting.
I might challenge how connected even in the rural settings they are to those larger systems, but absolutely. I think particularly we're talking about those systems. Those systems are hidden.
Yeah.
You know, the notion of why isn't the bus here? Well, the bus isn't here because you got construction, you know, the next two blocks over, and that your bus can't get here. So those are one of the key things. The water, obviously, is a big one. Food is another big one where they don't see the systems that are there, even though they see them visibly. So that's why we feel that's really an important opportunity, because to connect the things they care about to a system, to make them recognize the actual environment that's around them, it seems to be a big, important first step before you can even get to the idea of the natural environment. And again, and it goes back to, for a lot of folks here, you know, green space and trees is not the norm. It's
right.
It's a nice little thing that's there. There may be a park, and again, we have one of the biggest, largest urban parks in anywhere in the country. Yet again, if you're not right on its border, you may not see it or connect to it. So having those, you know, what's the environment they live in, and how does climate affect that environment is the more important approach to take here than, like I say, than the larger notion of environment, or particularly global.
Yep. Yeah. Good.
This is Michelle Ozent. Thank you so much. It's incredibly interesting to hear all this. I'm trying to figure out more about what were the goals in terms of the audience's outcomes. Well, you mentioned that you were concerned about, you know, maybe conflicting messages and what impact those might be having. And I'm trying to figure out if you actually had a chance to measure. You also said that I've picked up pieces here and there about lack of awareness of climate change to begin with. Then you had some concern about conflicting messages. So I understand all that. I was trying to figure out what was it that you were hoping that audiences would learn or take away from whatever changes that you hope to implement or did implement.
Sure. I think one of the first level pieces is that we need to be able to connect them to this at all. The conflicting message, I think, makes it easy for people to completely tune it out. It's easy for me, you know, and again, it's also very clear that, you know, if I'm worried about, you know, keeping my lights on, the notion of what's being burned to keep my lights on is so far removed from my world as to not matter to me. So there's, but be able to connect those actions that, and you know, Scott was mentioning this notion of connecting it to environment. So much of the larger messages have been about environmental conservation, but this bigger idea of global climates, that's so removed from a lot of these folks that the notion of climate literacy, the notion of engaging in any of the messages or efforts that are out there, are very separate from what they see from their day-to-day lives. So how do we create that bridge? And that's the thing, one of the most important parts of this, is how do we create a bridge that connects people to this as an issue, that connects them to this as something that's part of their world?
So I see what you're saying. So you're saying that the idea of that, no, it's not a problem out there, but it's something that's going to affect you and affect, like you were saying earlier, maybe your food supply, maybe your utility bill, that kind of a thing.
Well, yeah, and it's also a huge opportunity. I think that's the other thing, too, is that one of the pieces about this is we want to stay away from the doom and gloom, because that's another way, again, you know, this notion of the you know, how much worry can you actually carry with you, is that for a lot, particularly in urban settings, this is a huge opportunity. There are, so it's the question of when we're going to work to reclaim a space, or you know, put in a new lot, or someone's going to put in that building, or we're going to, you know, this construction is going to happen here in my neighborhood, what do I want it to be? You know, I want to have the green space, I want to have the permeability, I want to have the roofing the right way, mm-hmm. to connect those things, because those matter directly to their quality of life, and if we can connect positive change they make to improve their quality of life, that reinforces adaptation and mitigation, that's where the win is going to come. Because people are much more motivated by, I want to make my life better, than, you know, an abstract, preventing an abstract risk.
Mm-hmm.
So again, that's why, again, if we can connect these things they're passionate about to the systems that matter, and then, you know, ideally, and that they have a voice in as well. You know, they have that's where they have some opportunity to, whether to block this this issue, or to, you know, to block this, or to fight the, you know, fight the notion of recycling is kind of a trivial one now, but it's certainly a good, that basically over the last 5 years, Philadelphia has had to pay people to recycle. It's the only way to get them to do it, because it was, again, very much in the abstract. But if you could take those notions, those actions, and put them into improving your quality of life, that's where we have, I think, a real chance to make a stronger impact than kind of the, you know, more generic notions.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Comment?
Go ahead.
No, I'm just asking for any comments or questions.
So this is Frank Niebold again. I have a follow-up question. You mentioned that you were doing the Six Americas research, and I'm wondering, one of the things in the Six Americas is a question relating to, if you could ask a climate expert one question, and one of the things it showed was, of the six groups, basically, those questions broke down into, how do you know it's a problem? Is it going to hurt me? What can we do? Do you find that set of kind of different people are in different places based on the way they think showing up in urban environments as well? Because, you know, you would change your programming, your approach, your ask, your, you know, expectations based on those very different places that people might be.
Right. I think that's certainly true, that we see a level of that differentiation. But again, the thing that we see most importantly is that it's way down on the list, you know, that it's really down there in terms of, and you know, in many cases, you know, you're talking on an individual basis. Yeah, that makes sense. If I'm worried about, is my kid being able to breathe, then that's going to take priority. But we also saw, you know, and again, this is kind of going a little off the question there, but, you know, the expectation is that, well, I live in South Philly, there is a refinery in South Philly, and so that's why my kid has asthma. You know, it's, again, that superficial connection that they are making in terms of this. So I think when we talk about that, I'd have to go back and look at this, and I would be, my gut would be, is that a climate what? To
right.
That question, mm-hmm. If you actually ask that, is because it's not, you know, if I could ask a climate scientist that, it's for a lot of folks, this is far from their mind. The connection needs to be drawn much more personally to view that, again, because I think it's still seen as very, very abstract in terms of this. And it's a step before, you know, think global, act local. You need to be able to think and understand local to act local first.
And, you know? And Steve, I think this goes back to something you said earlier, so it's really a question. Does it link back to your earlier statements about not only about relevance, but about, how do I say this, about providing people with some actions that they can take and guiding that whole level of thinking rather than leaving it to people to make both the connections and the so what and
right.
what can I do about it.
Right.
So that those what can you do about it and so what questions are part of the messaging, but they're all local and relevant to people rather than to climate scientists.
Yeah, I think that's certainly very true. And again, it's about connecting them. And from a longer-term sustainability is, it's how do you connect them into the groups and the communities that are acting? Because I guess that's what the action has to be. And again, we see this evidence about how the neighborhood identity is so strong. This idea of how do you enjoin that neighborhood identity to those groups who are identifying, taking action or doing something like this, or even just understanding it. I think that's one of the other things we certainly see in Philadelphia that's endemic across this, and we know it's endemic across a lot of areas, is that in Philadelphia, we think of ourselves as a city of Rocky and cheesesteaks, not Franklin or the lightning rod. So the idea of science being part of our identity, or that understanding science, understanding climate, is part of who we are, is a very removed piece. And I think we've got to do that groundwork to get people to think of where to get people to care about this in a really thoughtful, meaningful way, as opposed to just recycle because otherwise it's bad. In a meaningful way,
thoughtful,
then we're going to have to
meaningful way for them, though, not for scientists. Yeah.
Well, exactly. For them, it is going to have to be about making the connection. It's going to have to be about them seeing that as part of who they are. And one way of doing that is to make them recognize that it's something about that's part of who their neighborhood is, that their neighborhood cares about this issue. And I say their neighborhood cares about this issue because it impacts their neighborhood in this way. It's an opportunity for their neighborhood, or it's a risk to their neighborhood, and it's something that they care about as a group. That's a way to connect it. And again, it's the idea of another way of making it very personal, maybe about identity, self-identity, than an abstract, good or bad action.
Yeah, what you've said, for me, the concrete example that is a perfect exemplar of what you've said is the Baltimore neighborhood tape under Earth the Operator Manual, little mini tapes that we've talked about earlier on this call.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether that rings a bell for anybody, but the little clips that
Jeff
provided.
Yeah.
There's one from a Baltimore neighborhood that does exactly what you just described, Steve.
Right. Right.
Any other questions or comments? Any last thoughts, Steve? It's been really good.
Just to follow up, if I take the Six Americas work, Steve, and I think about it, the disengaged seem to be what you're describing the most, which is this just isn't an issue for me. I've got so many other things. If you ask me any question, I don't know. That's how the way Tony Lizowitz and Ed Maybach always describe that group. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. Just this is not important to me.
Right.
And that you're talking about an approach of how to make it important to them, that this is actually part of the things you care about. But I would assume that there are also other segments of that audience who are alarmed or concerned about this issue, and that they would want to have a different conversation because they're already there. And what I'd look for in the data is, do you have a segment that are alarmed and concerned? Because we tend to focus on one group, and when we find ourselves in a lot of different types of groups, we're ready for one but not ready for the other, and we haven't really focused on the disengaged very well. We focused on the alarmed and concerned to some degree, right? But what do you do when you have this group over there and that group over there? It's more a rhetorical question, but I think it's a reality as we move into complicated communities.
No, I think that's absolutely true, and I think it's the and that's why I think, you know, it's about the full piece. You know, there's the group you need to connect both to the urban system, even to be aware. You need to be able to connect them to climate, and then you need to be able to connect them to this notion of what do I do. And what we've discovered with the concerned and alarmed communities, their questions tend to be, right, what can I do about it? And so that has to be part of this, because even if you get that group who, you know, from, you know, into that concerned category, if you finally give them some awareness of what's going on there, you need to be able to give them something to act on, something to do about it. Otherwise, we know that leads to, you know, a bad thing, a kind of powerless depression. And that's not something you want to engender in a community that, in these communities. So providing that place that says, well, how do we connect this back? And that's, again, why the community approaches are great, because these are all groups who have opportunities in these neighborhoods for people to continue on. You know, it's about getting them connected and then connecting them onto organizations that have that neighborhood and that audience particularly in mind and how they move them forward. And that helps with the concerned and the alarmed, because that's one of the key things is that action. And then part of what we're doing here is we're also working with our mayor's group, Office of Sustainability, and the larger Philadelphia, New York, Pittsburgh, all these cities who have these approaches, what are they doing to be able to try and connect these things back? So there should be opportunities built along the way, because the big thing here is the first step is getting them from disengaged. But then we have to have the road the rest of the way forward. Otherwise we've done a nice intervention and we've left them in the lurch.
But that, to me, that doesn't necessarily, I can envision a community like the Baltimore Energy Challenge community that's totally engaged and people have cut their utility bills 10 to 20% and they're really an engaged community. I can envision them on the Six Americas kind of survey totally being out in left field because they don't connect it with climate change.
So Karen, are you saying that they, you know, how much they connect it to climate change, it may not matter because they've moved forward in their community for a completely different reason, done the right thing for climate change without necessarily knowing that they've done it.
Correct.
Do you hear that one?
And that they might have contributed to some Baltimore sustainability citywide challenge, but that might be the farthest that it goes, and it may have no connection to the words climate change in their heads at all. You're right.
Yeah. So, we know that's true. Actually, one of our partners did a with a neighborhood and two different neighborhoods, one more affluent and one very much not. That kind of challenge: who can cut their utility bills down? That group that again from the more disadvantaged neighborhood beat the crap out of them. just wiped the floor with them, and we're very proud of that, but it had no connection, really, what it was about. It was about that first step. They were passionate. Their bills went down.
That was the
other final reward. And they were a community that could work together. Yeah.
Absolutely. So the question is now, how do we connect that to the next step of understanding? If they're engaged in that way, how do we connect it so that they can see the bigger picture because they're primed to do so?
I think, Steve, that's exactly where, I mean, that's a very specific strategy, which is, you know, you don't need to know about climate change in order to do the right thing for climate change. But once you've done it, it might be important for you to know that just this thing you just did is exactly what we need you to do. And so you should feel good about the problem already as opposed to lamenting the problem before you even commit to solving it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's a complicated one, but I, Karen, I appreciate your point there. But it's tricky, but I think there's a good lesson for us here.
Yeah. And my question is, do they really need to know all about the climate science?
How much literacy is required? That's great. We've always asked that question, haven't we?
Yeah.
But, I mean, Karen, I come back to the question of, you know, if all the climate models are correct, and we think that they are, in 30, 50 years, do we want to have them look back and go, oh, this is what you were talking about? Why didn't we do more? So, anyway, I'll leave it there.
Well, we're almost at the top.
It's not that I have the answer. It's a question that plagues me.
I,
Yes.
All the time.
Me as well.
All of us. Well, I was just going to say it's almost the top of the hour, and I think it's a great time to wrap up. Thanks, Steve, so much for a great presentation. I really appreciate actually, I really like the diagram on personal passion, urban system, and changing climate, just to see it, how those interactions work. And it's interesting how a little diagram like that can sort of start thinking about various kinds of strategies for working this issue. Very good. I really appreciate that.
And thank you. Thank you all.
And just
nice
a reminder,
project.
Everyone,
thanks.
This is actually the end of our, if I can call it that, our season. Steve's presentation was the last of the scheduled presentations for sort of our academic year. So we are almost at summer, 2 days, and so for the next couple of months, in fact, we'll be on more of a informal discussion basis, but we will continue to meet every Tuesday at 1 Eastern, and we if we have a presentation that we really want to have folks experience, we'll make sure that you hear about it, and so we may have a couple of presentations during the summer, but nothing's planned at this stage. So that's where we're at. Any other questions and comments?
So, Scott, one other thing that I'm not sure when this is going to happen, but the CC, you know, this the CSEP Phase 2 funding decisions should be beginning, and the community will be beginning to get some notice of the decisions by NSF. But the one thing that we may want to tee up in the community is, so say you had a wonderful proposal, and for all good reasons, it didn't get funded because, you know, they're just NSF has not been able to fund everything, and there's wonderful work that's been thought about. What do we do now?
I think it's a great idea. I mean, this huge amount of work. As you know, the phase ones were basically an opportunity to start to put networks together and ideas. And I think it'd be very good to sort of at least put those things out there, quite frankly, you know, maybe even talk about what were in people's proposals and see if there are other ways in which we can fund them and make them happen in our various communities and states. I think that's a great idea, and we could certainly put that as a, you know, sort of a theme discussion in the next 2 or 3 weeks when those phase two funding letters go out.
Right.
I think that's a great idea, Frank. Absolutely. We don't want to lose that stuff. There's an enormous amount of work that's been done within, you know, the Climate Literacy Network community, tri-agency projects. You know, so let's not lose any of that stuff. Build on it.
Yeah, and they are proprietary. They are proprietary, so, you know, it's only, you know, each of them, and we only know of the ones that we know of. There are others that, you know, were non-phase ones that we don't know of. And so how do we engage the wider circle is an open question.
Yeah, it's not just the CSEP or tri-agency projects. It's a lot.
Exactly.
Well, that's a sort of another thing for us to really be looking at. I think that's a great topic for a discussion in the next couple of weeks. Great. Any other comments? If not, that's a wrap for today. And thanks again to Steve for presenting. It's really interesting work to us. Thanks again.
Thank you all.
Yes. And thanks, Scott.
Yeah, and we should have a recording up in hopefully in a couple of hours. Excellent. Thanks again to everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.